Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. We'll be hearing some strong words from a senior Canadian politician about Donald Trump's plans for tariffs in about 30 minutes. But we're beginning with the latest illustration of just how violently the relationship between the US and Europe is currently being shaken up. None more so than over the fate of Ukraine. Since Friday's on-camera bust-up between President Zelensky and President Trump, European leaders have been scrambling to assemble a coalition to shore up Ukraine, to formulate some sort of alternative peace framework between Ukraine and Russia that they might present to Donald Trump and somehow keep Washington on side. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has been trying to take the lead on all that. This is what he had to say in Parliament today.
We must strengthen our relationship with America. For our security, for our technology, for our trade and investment. They are and always will be indispensable. And we will never choose between either side of the Atlantic. In fact, Mr. Speaker, if anything, the past week has shown that that idea is totally unserious. Because while some people may enjoy the simplicity of taking a side, this week has shown with total clarity that the US is vital in securing the peace we all want to see in Ukraine.
The British Prime Minister attempting to show the depth of British and European support for Ukraine, both morally and militarily, but also to show the value Britain and Europe put on the US role in all this. America is indispensable and vital, he said, and the US president committed to a lasting peace in Ukraine. But at the very time Mr. Starmer was updating members of Parliament, President Trump was taking to social media to imply that that repeated declaration of reliance on the US was naive and needy, and that the Ukrainian president was nearing the point of being a lost cause. Just over an hour ago, Mr. Trump spoke to reporters at the White House and had this to say about Mr. Zelensky.
Well, I just think he should be more appreciative because this country has stuck with them through thick and thin. We've given them much more than Europe, and Europe should have given more than us, because, as you know, that's right there. That's the border. This country really was like the fence on the border. It was very important to Europe. And I'm not knocking Europe. I'm saying that just they were a lot smarter than Joe Biden, because Joe Biden didn't have a clue. He just gave money hand over fist.
Emily Thornberry is a Member of Parliament for the governing Labour Party in Britain, and she's chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. What does she make of all these latest interventions?
I think that it's all a real emotional roller coaster at the moment. Having seen the President of France and Prime Minister of Britain in the Oval Office, and there seeming to be progress, and then the really distressing scenes on Friday. And I know that everyone was very, very worried. And then back again at the weekend, we have the Prime Minister of Britain stepping up and seeming to, I think, get it absolutely pitch perfect and essentially making it clear that Britain, Europe and the United States need to work with Ukraine in order to ensure that Ukraine is sufficiently strong and that there is a peace and that it isn't that they lose and we don't just roll over and let Putin have whatever he wants. We need to make clear to the Russians that what it is that's expected. But also, we also know that we can't trust Putin because it's happened before. He signs up to things and then he just breaks the agreement. So we need to have a security guarantee. So then the question is, who's going to provide it? And what Keir Starmer has been trying to do this weekend is initiate discussions, serious discussions, from the Europeans about what it is that they're going to do in order to ensure that Ukraine is safe. But we do need to have, as a backstop, American involvement, because there are things the Americans can do that the Europeans just don't do as well. So air cover, intelligence, long-range missiles, these sorts of things are what the Americans can do better than Europe can do. But what we need to do is come to terms with reality, which is that this is primarily a European problem. I mean, it's obviously a world problem, but it's primarily a European problem. And we need to take responsibility for what we can do, which is spend more on defence and ensure that we are defending Ukraine from any potential future aggression from Russia.
The problem is that, you know, I mean, clearly we've got the Trump administration's reluctance to be involved, but also there seems to be a sort of a very different approach in terms of Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, and the rest of Europe is saying, look, Putin can't be trusted, which is precisely why we need the American Security Guarantee. President Trump is saying Putin can be trusted.
I think that, I mean, it's difficult to tell, but I think that President Trump begins from a position of we have to stop this war and there needs to be peace. And so I think we have to kind of rise up and greet that and go, yeah, yeah, no, you're right. We need to have peace. And then I think he thinks that because there has been support for Ukraine, that the Ukrainians are in some way dragging this out. And so that's why we do need to very seriously start thinking about what peace looks like and making sure that there is a peace process started. But we can't do it from a position of, well, we'll just agree to what the Russians say. I mean, obviously not.
In terms of trying to strengthen Ukraine, I saw figures in The Economist magazine that suggested that the Nordics and most East European countries have contributed in terms of arms to Ukraine between 1% and 2.5% of GDP of their national economic output. Germany and Britain, less than 0.2% of GDP. Do you think that specifically that Britain needs to do more in terms of sending weaponry to Ukraine?
Well, there's been a number of things that we've done. It hasn't just been about weaponry. It's also, we've also been training Ukrainian troops, and we've also been giving very large amounts of aid. So there's been you have to help on a number of fronts.
And in terms of, you've been full of praise about how the Prime Minister has sort of tried to do the diplomacy and try to sort of dance the fine line that he is doing between Europe and Ukraine on the one hand and perhaps President Trump on the other. Peter Mandelson, the new British ambassador in Washington, did say over the weekend in an interview that President Zelensky should give unequivocal backing to the Trump initiative. May I ask what you make of that?
So what I make of it is that Peter is sort of saying what I'm saying, which is that first and foremost, what President Trump wants is peace. He wants an end to the war. And that does align with our interests. We do want an end to the war too. So it's really just a question on what terms. That's the point.
Mm. You know, he did say unequivocal backing of the Trump initiative.
Yeah, but you see, there's also not a great deal of flesh on the bones in terms of what kind of peace the Trump administration wants, which is what one of the things which the Europeans are stepping up in order to try to accomplish. The push comes from America. We need to have peace. We all agree. The question is on what terms. And, you know, there's much work going on behind the scenes, but part of that is, what does peace look like? What would be sustainable? How can we ensure that the Ukrainians remain safe and a sovereign nation and have some justice? You know, these are the questions that need to be answered. And what I understand the Europeans are going to do is, once the work has been done, to go back to the Americans and go, here we are. This is what peace looks like.
Emily Thornberry, Labour Member of Parliament and Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in Britain. The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has been widely reported over the weekend to have ordered US Cyber Command to stop offensive digital operations against Russia. The move's believed to have been ordered last week before President Donald Trump's heated meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky from Ukraine at the White House, the one that I mentioned at the top of the programme. A number of officials are reported to have suggested that the move to cease this type of cyber operations against Russian targets does come, though, as President Trump attempts to broker an end to the war in Ukraine with Moscow. Jason Kichter served for more than 20 years in the US Marine Corps, including 7 years at US Cyber Command. He's now Senior Vice President at the cyber vulnerability company Automox. What does he make of these reports?
I think my initial reaction was one of surprise, because there had been some additional commentary suggesting the pause had extended to planning, and that would be very unusual. You may cease offensive operations or information operations. You might pause exercises or even speeches that could be viewed as provocative, but to pause planning or intelligence collection would be extremely unusual. And I think that was part of the initial confusion when this story came out.
Right. And can you explain what offensive, you were hinting at some of them there, but what offensive cyber operations actually look like?
Right. So what we'd be talking about in this context would be things, as you know, general examples, disrupting Russian cyber espionage or effects operations, degrading Russian military command and control, disrupting Russian military logistics supply chains, and running information operations to try to erode their will to fight. So right. Those would be the kinds of things that you would typically pause during a negotiation. And not every time. It's not uniform, but it is something that we have done from time to time across different administrations.
But some of those things that you were just mentioning, I mean, if you're talking about disrupting, for example, Russian military supply and control, I mean, that could have a real impact on the war in Ukraine, couldn't it?
Right. And so that's the trade-off here is you can do this and not say anything about it and just purely from the perspective of trying to not undermine the talks. You can do it and then tell your adversary that you've done it as a sign of good faith, but that could embolden them. What if you stop and then the adversary doesn't notice? Right, then they might be emboldened towards future or further adventurism. And then there's the one-sidedness of it, of just because you did it doesn't mean that they will automatically reciprocate. And so you may no longer be putting as much pressure on them to come to the table and talk.
Right. I mean, and given this, I'm clearly, one can ascribe what the motives are. It's to sort of create this atmosphere of good faith. But I mean, have you, in your experience, come across this type of apparently unilateral offer before?
I have. This is something I've seen during previous administrations, including Biden and Obama and even the first Trump administration. So it's not deeply unusual. It is somewhat rare, but it's not wildly unusual. I think where it starts to cause concern is, other things that may be paired with it. And so there's a difference between slowing down a bit so that you don't step on talks and looking like your heart's not in it. And I think that's where you want to use extreme caution to ensure you're not sending mixed signals to a competitor nation.
Jason Kichter, formerly of U.S. Cyber Command and now Senior Vice President at the tech company Automox. Just a quick look ahead to a story we're going to be covering in about 15 minutes, and that's reaction in Canada to Donald Trump insisting that 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico are going to come into force midnight local time. U.S. stocks have just closed. And they closed down sharply lower after Donald Trump did confirm those tariffs would come into effect. This is NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, the prize-winning Nigerian-born novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie talks about her new novel and the distress of not being able to write fiction for quite some time.
When I could not write, it was terrifying. It felt like being shut out from myself. And it's a really frightening place to be. I wanted to write fiction and I couldn't. And I just really felt terror. I felt terror. I thought, what if I never write again?
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, more from her in about 30 minutes. Our main headline this hour, so we've been saying, Donald Trump has said that President Zelensky must be more appreciative. He's denied, though, that he's considering ending military support for Ukraine just 3 days after the two men clashed at the White House. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Two people have been killed and 10 injured after a car hit a crowd of people in the German city of Mannheim. The vehicle appears to have been driven at high speed through a busy shopping area as people were celebrating a carnival season. Police have arrested a 40-year-old German man. It's the latest in a series of violent incidents involving cars in Germany. Stephanie Bach is a reporter with the local media outlet Mannheim 24.
There was a lot of blood. It was really hectic. Like, a lot of people were just coming out from the city center. They were like a little bit panicked. They were calling their families and friends, tell them what they saw, tell them what they've heard, and asking them if it's true. all the shopping centers and restaurants were closing. No one wanted to talk. It was just like, I want to get out of here. I don't feel safe. I'm afraid.
Well, shortly before we came on air, the German police gave an update saying that they didn't believe that the driver was acting out of ideological extremism, but rather that he was, as they put it, psychologically unwell. Thomas Sparrow is security correspondent for Deutsche Welle, the German public service broadcaster. How significant does he think this latest information is from the authorities?
It is very significant indeed, because the motivation will determine, and it has been in the past, will determine the political reactions that you see both at a local or regional level and also at a federal level here in Berlin. So the fact that authorities are not thinking of a political background or an extremist background, but are rather looking into mental health issues, will also determine what kind of concrete reactions you will see coming in the next few days.
Mm. I mean, I guess, though, it still leaves the problem that Germany does seem to have a problem with car ramming attacks.
It definitely has a problem with car ramming attacks, but each of the three most recent car ramming attacks had different motivations. You had the incident in Magdeburg during the Christmas market, and that was carried out by a Saudi man with anti-Muslim views. You had a car ramming in Munich in February, which was carried out allegedly by an asylum seeker from Afghanistan who had Islamist motivations, according to authorities. And now you have a car ramming in Mannheim. And the main suspect there, you said it also in your introduction, is not said to have a political background. So there are three separate incidents. What they do have in common is, I would say, two things. The first one, the fact that there, because of these three incidents, there's a heightened sense of insecurity among many Germans. And the second one is that these security incidents, alongside a couple of other security incidents, especially two knife attacks, have basically made this issue a top issue in the political discussion in Germany, especially when it comes to the election that was held on February 23rd, the general election here in Germany.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the problem for the authorities, especially when it comes to car ramming, it's, I mean, obviously one can change things with regards to the way in which there is street furniture and bollards and barriers and all that sort of thing. It's not easy, though, is it?
It's not easy. And in fact, in the Magdeburg attack in December, you had the situation where you have Christmas markets that were protected by bollards. And the man who drove through the Christmas market actually found the emergency exit through which he then drove his car. What I'm trying to say with this is that authorities have stressed time and time again that it's impossible for them to guarantee 100% security. Mm. So the measures that they're trying to include are, on the one hand, obviously more police security, more police presence, but also focusing, for example, on prevention and on other issues as well. And that is something that we're going to hear in Germany in the next few days, definitely.
Thomas Sparrow, security correspondent from Deutsche Welle. We've got a disturbing BBC investigation to bring you now. TikTok making profits from live stream selling sexual content in Kenya, with some involving teenagers as young as 15. The BBC has found examples of young women selling sexually explicit video in real time, with TikTok taking more than 70% cut from gifts sent to them via the platform. Whistleblowers and the company that moderates TikTok say that TikTok knows this is happening, but is failing to take adequate action, despite its own rules stating that the selling of sex is banned. Dibula Kamoli has this report.
It's after midnight in Nairobi, and I'm on TikTok Live.
My number is on the bio, guys. Inbox.
Yes, come now.
In this one, young women are taking it in turns to dance provocatively. There's 450 people watching from around the world. And there's a host who's directing them and calling on people to send them money in the form of digital gifts.
Guys, please, elevate Amazon. Elevate dancer.
There's a flurry of activity. Icons of roses, cowboy hats, money guns explode onto the screen. Payments are coming through.
Thank you so much.
At the end of another live stream, the women say, "Inbox me for sexual content." I've come across many late night live streams on TikTok like this, where young women are soliciting sex work.
We're in a low-income neighborhood, one of the poorer neighborhoods in Eastland. And in places like this, there's that sense of urgency of trying to get money daily because people are not living off a salary, you know. People are hustling every day.
We're meeting someone we're calling Esther. She's now 17, but says she was recruited to dance on TikTok Live 2 years ago when she was just 15.
I sell myself on TikTok. I dance naked, live. I do that because that's where I can earn money to support myself. When you're dancing live, some people will contact you.
She then uses another platform to share sexual content or arrange physical meetings. She says the man who recruited her takes a cut of everything she earns and pressured her to have sex with him.
I told him I was 15 years old. He said it is okay, and he loves young girls below 18, and he gives them work.
Charities say they are seeing more cases of child sexual exploitation through live streaming. Dr. Issa Kapera is acting country director for Child Fund Kenya.
It's both people, both locals and foreigners, target these young girls. And these young girls also, because of poverty, they're driven to look for money from people who offer them sexual, whatever, we call it sextortion.
TikTok's guidelines ban the selling of sexual services, and users need to be 18 in order to live stream and receive gifts. TikTok outsources its content moderation to another company called Teleperformance. One of their content moderators agreed to speak as long as we disguised his identity.
TikTok actually knows what's happening in Kenya, but they're not doing anything to solve it. It's all about business. Live content that is sexual in nature tend to appear at night. I think they've started to cover nighttime, but moderation should never stop. There's also inefficiency of the artificial intelligence. The AI is not enough to select content which is pornographic or soliciting sex.
A spokesperson for TikTok said in a statement that they have zero tolerance for exploitation and they enforce strict safety policies, including robust live content rules and moderation in 70 languages, including Swahili.
Dabuli Kamuli with that report, and if you want to hear the full investigation, do search BBC The Documentary online or wherever you get your podcasts. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Pakistan is pressing ahead with the deportation of Afghans, despite the United Nations warning that some of those Afghans have been registered by the UN Refugee Agency as being in need of international protection. 930 people were sent back in the first half of February. Pakistan says its policies are aimed at all illegal foreign nationals. Our Pakistan correspondent Azadeh Moshire has been speaking to some of the families with members in hiding. We've withheld or changed their names to protect their identities.
Ahmad walks us through his neighbourhood. Many of the homes he shows us seem empty. He and his family have chosen to stay, but hide when they hear the police is nearby. He says he used to work for a Western charity in Afghanistan and was in the final stages of a US resettlement programme. 2 weeks ago, when he was out shopping, he received a call. It was his daughter's voice on the line.
My baby, 3 years, called me, "Come, Baba, here is the police. Yeah, police came to our homes."
Ahmad had his visa extended, but his wife was still waiting for hers. The police said they'd have to take her and his child to Haji camp, where many Afghans in Islamabad and Rawalpindi are being held. He decided to go with them. He shows me a video similar to ones other Afghans have sent me. In it, men, women and children are being driven away.
The situation was unimaginable and was very bad, particularly for women and children. Per family only one blanket, and also they collect the phone of everyone, and our communication cut with outside.
Ahmad's family was released 3 days later. We've come here to Haji Camp to try to verify some of the accounts we're hearing, but officials and the police here won't let us in. The Pakistani government does insist that no one is mistreated during the repatriation process. There are also some Afghans around us, some people who have come here to search for their relatives who they say are being held in the camp. Pakistan has taken in millions of Afghans over more than 40 years. The UN says there are about 3 million in the country today. But Pakistan is frustrated by what it calls very slow resettlement programs in other countries and says this problem can't go on forever. Families like Nabila's are terrified of what that could mean for them. At 10 years old, her life is limited to the confines of her home in Islamabad and the dirt road outside it. Her father Hamid served in the Afghan military. They believe he and their family will be punished or killed if they return.
Don't force us out. Don't kick Afghans out of their homes. We are not here by choice.
The Taliban government has told the BBC all Afghans can live in the country without any fear. But the UN has previously cast doubt on an amnesty. Pakistan says its policies are aimed at all illegal foreign nationals. But Afghans we've spoken to feel their lives are hanging by a thread and their time in Pakistan running out.
And that was Azadeh Moshiri reporting from Islamabad. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. It's a big day for Canada tomorrow, Tuesday, a big and probably quite tough day. As promised, President Trump has confirmed in the last couple of hours that he is imposing tariffs of 25% on all imports from Canada, as well as Mexico.
Tomorrow, tariffs 25% on Canada and 25% on Mexico, and that'll start. So they're going to have a tariff. So what they have to do is build their car plants, frankly, and other things in the United States, in which case they have no tariffs.
Mr. Trump has also just signed an order for 20% tariffs on Chinese exports to the United States. It does feel, though, as if Canada is particularly exposed. Three quarters of its exports head over its southern border. President Trump says he's doing it to correct trade imbalances, as far as he sees it. Other countries are taking advantage of the American market. He's also demanded that both Canada and Mexico do more to stop the flow of opioids and unauthorized immigrants, and that Canada become the 51st state of the US. The province of British Columbia is in the far west of Canada and exports lumber, aluminium, oil and gas and various high-tech services to the US. The Premier of BC is David Eby. How is he viewing the prospect of these tariffs?
In some ways, it's just confusing from the Canadian perspective. So, for example, we produce aluminium here in British Columbia, the majority of which goes to the United States. They have no internal way to produce that aluminium. It's basically solid electricity, and the cost of aluminum is the electricity to produce it, and their electrical rates are so high it makes it uneconomic to produce it in the United States. And so what they're doing is essentially imposing a tariff on themselves for a product that they have to import from Canada. It's the same for wood. You know, they put recent softwood lumber duties on, they've increased those, they're going to put another 25% on. If you're rebuilding in North Carolina from floods or in LA from fires, you're just adding 25% to the cost of your home building.
Certainly there are voices in the U.S. who are saying, look, this is going to inflict a certain amount of damage on the American economy. It could be inflationary and all the rest of it. But I guess the point is that Canada is just that much more exposed. You export roughly five times more from you to them than from them to you. You're over the barrel, aren't you?
Well, it's certainly incredibly challenging for Canadian companies and for governments. The strange thing is, when you look at the trade numbers, the majority of what we're selling to the United States are energy inputs, electricity, natural gas, petroleum products from British Columbia, wood. These are all things that go into value-added products in the United States. But if you take out energy, for example, there's a significant trade deficit with the United States, where we're buying more from Americans than we're selling. So it's going to hurt Canadians, it's going to hurt Americans, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to us, and it's created a huge amount of uncertainty.
How can you prepare for this?
Well, there are some goods we produce, and aluminum is a good example, where it can go on a boat and it can ship off to another market. It doesn't have to go to the United States.
But can you so quickly find other markets?
No, it's hugely disruptive. It's problematic. It adds costs for everybody. There are many products we produce that are in demand around the world. There are lots where the main and only customer is in the United States. And so those businesses are in a serious jam, which puts the entire public here in Canada in jam, because there's tax revenues that fund public services that everyone depends on. So diversification of markets has become even more important than it was before. Reaching out to customers in other countries across the Pacific is absolutely vital. I know that there have been many renewed discussions with the EU, and I imagine that we'll be heading in the same direction with the UK. I know the Prime Minister is there right now. And so I think that from the Canadian perspective, getting away from this model of dependence on the United States, it's been a long overdue wake-up call for Canadian businesses and governments that we need to work together closely to diversify far more aggressively than we have.
The president has made it clear that it's not just about the economics, but it's also about his ambition for Canada to become the 51st state of the US. It's difficult for you to deal with that in, for example, economic terms.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, we can make all the arguments about Americans paying more money and so on, and that it doesn't make a lot of economic sense. And here's what a car part does going back and forth across the border, and everyone benefits. But at the end of the day, if your goal is to absorb Canada into the United States, I mean, that's the president's own mission. I can tell you this, Canada will never be the 51st state, and we'll fight tooth and nail, as we always have. The common cause, though, that has come from the threats from the president, in my experience, is unprecedented and remarkable. And it really does reflect that we take him seriously when he says he wants to make us the 51st state. I know a lot of Americans think he's just joking or it's not serious or whatever, but we do take it very seriously. And it's driving a lot of energy here in Canada to organize and make sure that we're in a much better position and we're never in this state again of being enthralled to one person in the White House.
And given your relationship with the United Kingdom and given that King Charles is the head of state and the fact that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been seeing King Charles today, do you want a statement from Buckingham Palace? Do you want a statement from the British government saying back off to President Trump?
I recognize that the UK is forging its own path and trying to establish a relationship with the president and be a bridge to Europe. And I think that's an absolutely vital role. If the prime minister can achieve that for the UK, I think that's very helpful. I suspect that the UK will feel the same kind of attention from the United States that we're getting right now at some point, whether it's tariff threats or military threats or whatever it is. It's just how the president operates. And we'll be there for the UK. And we certainly hope and expect that given our ties, sharing a king, being members of the Commonwealth, we're literally called British Columbia in the province that I serve, that we stick together. Because as the president threatens the entire world, it will require the entire world to stand together and draw a line in the sand.
Strong words to say that the president, President Trump, threatens the entire world.
And that's what he's doing. He's threatening the EU. He's cozying up to a dictator in Russia that invaded a peaceful neighbor. He's reordering the Western military alliances that have served us and free trade that have served many people for many generations in ways that are profoundly troubling. And I think that ultimately we're all going to have to stick together to respond to this very serious threat. And that means countries that value democracy, that value freedom and due process and regulatory checks and balances and all those other things that have brought the prosperity that we all depend on, that we're going to have to stick together.
And that was the Premier of British Columbia, David Eby. Is the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas about to collapse? It was always going to be difficult, very difficult, for the two sides to move from what was called phase one of the deal, a limited release of Israeli hostages, a larger release of Palestinian prisoners and a big increase in humanitarian aid into the battered enclave, to phase two, a full hostage release and a complete Israeli military pullout from Gaza. Phase one ended on Saturday. Swiftly afterwards, Israel said it was halting all aid deliveries into Gaza until Hamas releases more hostages. David Mensah is the Israeli government spokesman.
Get real. The aid we send is used to kill. No more. No free meal to those who kill. Israel will not allow the Hamas terrorist organization to continue the ceasefire under the conditions of the first stage without releasing our hostages.
Speaking from the southern Gazan city of Rafah, Rosalia Bolen from the UN's children agency UNICEF said the effect of the Israeli stop on aid deliveries was already being felt.
At the moment, we have some items left that we had collected previously, but because the needs in Gaza are just staggering, we have been trying to distribute the items that we've been bringing in as soon as we could. So we've been handing them out to families, to the most vulnerable children and families in Gaza as soon as possible.
She said it wasn't just about food and medicine, but importantly, shelter.
Some areas are more affected than others. For instance, in Rafah, in Khan Yunis, Jabalia, there's hardly any buildings still standing. The buildings that are still standing look like they're about to collapse. People who have been displaced, and the vast majority of the population has been displaced, they have no homes to return to.
So where are we with the efforts to move to phase two of the ceasefire? Paul Adams is our correspondent in Jerusalem.
What the Israelis are saying is that they have agreed to an American proposal, and we haven't seen any word from the Americans, so we have to take the Israelis at face value on this, that this is an American bridging proposal designed to extend phase one of the ceasefire for another 50 days or so, in which time around half of the Israeli hostages, alive and dead, would be released at the beginning and another half at the end. And those 50 days would be used to negotiate the next steps forward. Now, from Hamas's point of view, that raises the very real prospect of giving up all the hostages, which is all the leverage that they have in this situation, in return for no guarantees at all that Israel intends to withdraw militarily. And when you hear Israeli officials talking, as they do a great deal at the moment, about going back to war with even greater ferocity, you can understand why Hamas at the moment is saying absolutely not. We must stick to the original deal, the original second phase, which would see the gradual release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners, and crucially, the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip.
So how do you read this, Paul? Because on the one hand, I mean, I hear what you're saying about, you know, we've yet to hear from the US as to whether this really is their proposal and their sort of bridging idea. But we're also, I mean, we've been told or given to understand that President Trump and his envoy, Steve Witkoff, are really, really keen for this, you know, for the war in Gaza to come to an end. So how are you reading it?
Yes, and they appear to be, as they are with everything, in a hurry. It's almost certain that Hamas is coming under a great deal of pressure from the mediators, including the Egyptians and Qatar, to come up with some kind of deal here. But, you know, I think there is this growing realization that ultimately this is going to be resolved by fighting. If Hamas is not willing to put down its arms, and it's made a great show of you know, demonstrating that it's still a force to be reckoned with these displays every time hostages are released and so forth, they do not show any willingness to militarily to disappear from the scene, quite the reverse. And so there is this growing sense that ultimately Benjamin Netanyahu will decide to go back to war, the only question being how many hostages he can secure in the meantime. I heard one Israeli commentator who's thought to be very close to the Israeli prime minister saying that essentially what Mr. Netanyahu is trying to do at the moment is shrink the hostage problem to the point where maybe a handful of hostages remain. And at that point, the gloves will come off and Israel will go back to war and finish the job, which obviously a lot of the prime minister's critics and others looking on from outside say is a fool's errand. It can't be done.
Correspondent Paul Adams in Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. The Nigerian-born, US-based author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is often cited as one of the most influential global voices. Her essay, We Should All Be Feminists, was sampled by Beyoncé and appeared on T-shirts all over the world. Over the years, along with that essay, she's written novels, poetry and numerous short stories. But her book, new book, Dream Count, is a return to novels after more than a decade away. So why the long wait? She's been speaking to the BBC's Emma Barnett.
I couldn't write for a while, and then I started writing again.
What was it, do you think? What was the block?
I don't know, and I think it comes with creativity. This is what I tell myself to feel better. That sometimes when you want to create, you don't, and that maybe this is a good thing because maybe it shouldn't be easy. Mm. Right? Maybe creativity should come with difficulties to somehow make it deeper. This is all to cheer myself up. But I can tell you that when I could not write, it was terrifying. And it felt like being shut out from myself. And it's a really frightening place to be. Because writing is the thing that gives me meaning. Writing fiction, I should say.
Right.
And so when I couldn't, I wanted to write fiction and I couldn't. And I just really felt terror. I felt terror. I thought, what if I never write again?
And at the same time, in this period, you become a mother.
I did.
Three times over, I should say. There was a daughter. There is a wonderful daughter and now twin boys, 11 months old.
Yes.
That does something to you, of course, as well.
It does. Actually, my block, and I don't like to use that expression because I'm too superstitious.
Okay.
But my something that happened that I couldn't...
The space.
Yes, the space. That's good. Happened when I became pregnant. Something just changed. And I'm not sure that it was just entirely physiological, but something changed. And I just could not get back into that... into that sort of magical place where I can write fiction. I have always longed to be known, truly known by another human being. Sometimes we live for years with yearnings that we cannot name, until a crack appears in the sky and widens and reveals us to ourselves.
Dream Count tells a story of four women's lives interconnected, and you go into great detail about their stories and then some of those themes. But just to stay with this for a moment, it's also very visceral at times about women's health. Why did you make that choice? What are you doing there?
Well, I'm telling a story, but I think a number of things. I've always felt that when one writes fiction, realistic fiction as I do, that there is a kind of, there's a responsibility to honesty. To what I call a kind of radical honesty. Like we have to tell the truth. And it's interesting how little of literature is about women and women's bodies, women's sort of physicality. I mean, we all came from a woman. We all come from a woman's body. And that isn't really a thing that is explored very deeply in literature. And I hope that will change. So I felt it was important to do that, that we not to talk about childbirth as this sort of gauzy thing, that the next thing we see, the woman has the baby wrapped in white and she's gazing adoringly at the baby, that there's a lot that is, you know, almost animalistic about birthing a child. I think the greatest gift that I've had as a person in the world is to be a mother. But I also think it's important that literature, you know, engage with it in a way that's visceral and true and possibly uncomfortable.
You are now also the mother of sons, as we've said.
I am indeed.
And looking back at what you've said about feminism, and how are you going to avoid that cage of masculinity that you talked about?
Well, I'm determined to raise good men. And fortunately, they also have a good man for a father. That helps. I think I want to raise my boys to be in touch with emotion, to not be afraid of emotion, and also to not be afraid of fear. I think often we raise men to think that fear is this kind of thing that one must pretend not to feel. And to make them the kind of boys that never start a fight, but if you bring a fight to them, they will beat you up. That's kind of that's my game plan.
That's the plan at the moment. I mean, they're 11 months old, so it's quite a way to go. In 2014, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie published an essay of her popular TED talk that was her take on feminism that was then sampled by Beyoncé.
Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political and economic equality of the sexes.
Where are we with feminism now, do you think?
We should say that there is no place in the world where women are equal. There are places that are better and the places that are worse, but there is just gender equality does not exist yet. I think that what's happened in places like the US has been surprising because I did not think that we would be talking about women's reproductive rights in 2025, but we are. I think our bodies are the only things that we have that actually are ours when you really think about it. And I actually understand people who oppose abortion. I understand that position. I even respect that position. But it's a position you cannot impose on everyone. And to do that in policy, in law, just feels to me a way of saying that you do not recognize a woman's full humanity. Because if I cannot do something, this is all I have, this body. And if I can't do with it what I want, then you're really saying that I'm not fully human or fully a citizen. And I'm surprised that that's happening in the US. But I also think that I don't think it will last. You know, I don't think it will.
I mean, that's an aspect of it. We're also in a world, I'm thinking again, what's changed in, you know, the last more than a decade since you brought your last novel out. The Me Too movement's happened, but also the rise and rise and rise of social media.
Mm.
And how women themselves view themselves, augment themselves. What do you think the impact has been on the road to gender equality because of social media?
Mm. Actually, what worries me the most about social media is the impact on young people. It also rewires our brains.
Mm.
It changes us.
Yeah.
And I would like for something more noble to change us.
And then there's AI.
I remember reading a piece about AI writing a short story. And I thought, that's not a short story. We shouldn't even call it a short story. Human creativity and the human imagination, we should never think that we can somehow replace. As a writer, I care so much about the human imagination, about creativity, about our ability to tell stories. Just imagine our lives without storytelling. I mean, it would be bleak. We should be able to look into the future and say in 50 years, what's the world supposed to be? And what do we want the world to be? Because that's also important.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie speaking to the BBC's Emma Barnett and bringing this edition of NewsHour to a close. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.